You're listening to the Diplomats Asia Geopolitics Podcast. I'm your host, Katie Putz, coming to you from Washington, D.C.
And this is your co-host, Ankit Panda, also in Washington, D.C. How's it going, Katie?
Going pretty good. It's a weirdly cool day today, but I'm sure it will heat up again soon.
That's right. Right. Yeah, we've been a little delayed on our episode, so apologies to listeners there. There's been quite a few things going on, but Katie and I are back and looking forward to chatting today.
Yes. And I think one of the important things that happened this month that we do want to touch on is the South Korean snap presidential election, which our listeners will know was triggered by now former President Yoon's impeachment, which itself was triggered by Yoon's really shocking decision to declare martial law in early December. The recent election saw the Democratic Party's Lee Jae-myung beat out conservative People's Power Party's candidate Kim Moon-soo and others to secure the presidency. Lee, who had lost to Yoon back in 2022 by less than a percentage point, beat out Kim by just over 8 percentage points. Lee's election was pretty expected, I think. And South Korea, however, now enters a period of clear Democratic Party control, given that the party also holds a majority in the National Assembly. So Ankit, as South Korea kind of emerges from what has been months of domestic uncertainty, what is the geopolitical situation on and around the Korean Peninsula that the new Lee administration has to deal with?
Yeah, I think that's a great place to start. We can talk a bit about what the Lee Jae-myung administration thinks about Korean foreign policy. But first, I think it's important to understand, what they're inheriting. So I think the most important piece of the inheritance is, what you alluded to, which is this special election happening after probably one of the most serious crises in South Korea's post-democratic transition history, which is the martial law crisis last December, leading to the dramatic removal of Yoon Suk-yeol. But this, there's something that's really familiar about this particular constellation of events, right? For anybody tracking the Korean Peninsula, you might remember, Park Geun-hye was impeached, the previous conservative president, before Moon Jae-in, a progressive, came in a special election in, May 2017, in the first year that Donald Trump was inaugurated in Washington. And very coincidentally, we had a conservative president again impeached in December with a Donald Trump inauguration in January and I guess, almost May inauguration for a new progressive leader out of a special election, which is to say that, that's just a little bit of a historical rhyme there. Obviously, Northeast Asia is very different today. We have, let's start with the North Korea piece, which is really important. In 2017, we obviously had a major crisis with North Korea as they were crossing key thresholds with the development of their nuclear capabilities, including testing their first ICBMs. Now North Korea is in a very different place. They have more nuclear weapons, better nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons to hold South Korea at risk. You've had a growing debate in South Korea about building nuclear weapons. In fact, it's less of a debate and more of a, we should build nuclear weapons kind of sense among strategic elites and the broader public. So that's part of what this new progressive administration inherits. We can talk a bit about how they think about that. The Japan relationship got really bad under Moon Jae-in, the last progressive leader in South Korea. It improved under Yoon Suk-yeol, partly sort of catalyzed by a Biden administration in Washington that I think was very eager to see its two Northeast Asian allies get along and was more generally interested in minilateralizing America's security partnerships and alliances in Asia writ large. So we saw significant developments there. There was the Camp David summit with the three leaders, which was a notable hallmark of that moment. Lee Jae-myung comes in at a different moment in that South Korea-Japan relations haven't quite regressed to where they were under Moon Jae-in, but they certainly don't have that catalyst anymore in Washington because, as we've discussed repeatedly, the Trump administration just does not think in terms of minilaterals, right? It's all about that bilateralism that very much will likely take many of these Asian alliances back to their hub and spokes origins in a way. And then maybe, Katie, I'll turn it back to you. But, the last thing is obviously the China question, which is the, several hundred billion dollar elephant in the room for South Korea with massive economic dependency, but growing expectations from the United States that South Korea will play ball in geopolitical competition with China. That was a difficult proposition for South Korean conservatives who don't view China necessarily with a great degree of favor, but South Korean progressives have a very different perspective that sort of relates to the general perceptions about South Korea, you know, should be in an alliance with the United States, but should have greater strategic flexibility and autonomy. Lee Jae-myung has spoken about essentially pursuing a pragmatic foreign policy, which is a very good kind of bumper sticker, but what that means in practice is going to be a lot more challenging. And then, you know, maybe the last thing I'll say is this all comes at a moment when we've seen a lot of rumors in the press here in Washington that the Pentagon is considering significant modifications to the troop presence that the United States maintains on the Korean Peninsula, partly out of this broader discussion about, you know, will South Korea be ultimately useful in a competition or a potential contingency with China, because the U.S. ROK alliance has not had that traditional orientation, unlike the U.S. alliances with Australia and Japan, both of which in recent years have become a lot more overtly shaped towards managing the potential for a high-intensity conventional war over Taiwan. So that's some of the big-picture stuff. There's a lot more, you know, we can talk about some of the other diplomatic issues that are going to be lingering here, trade and so on. But really, it's about that kind of broader clash that we might expect between Lee Jae-myung's strategic autonomy disposition and what the United States under Donald Trump is looking for out of its alliances.
Yeah, well, you've done an excellent job of forecasting basically all of the questions I had to ask you. So awesome. We'll get deeper into many of those issues. But I do want to go back to the election itself and sort of the atmosphere of the election. You, as you noted, Lee won the election, was widely expected to win the election. How did you look at the outcome? You know, were there any surprises there for you in terms of regional balance or just the domestic conversation around the election?
Yeah, so look, I mean, I will say that the broader sense that Lee Jae-myung was favored to win was pretty strong especially post, you know, impeachment and removal of Yoon. Han Duck-soo, who was the caretaker prime minister, obviously had a bit of a rocky pathway, just given some of the internal discord in the conservative camp, where there was a bit of confusion, let's say, about whether Han, you know, should relinquish his position as an independent, become a conservative, and then we sort of went back and forth, which sort of led to this landslide result. So there was just discord in the conservative camp in South Korea, and, you know, we'll never know the counterfactual about what the election outcome looks like if you don't have that discord. But, you know, the thing to say about South Korean domestic politics is that it is just an incredibly polarized society, right? You have a tremendous amount of polarization, negative partisanship between conservatives and progressives. You have a remarkable gender polarization dynamic, particularly among younger voters. And so a big part of the story from at least reporters who focus on Korean domestic politics is that a big part of the domestic political base that propelled Lee Jae-myung to victory was younger women who vote overwhelmingly progressive compared to younger men in South Korea who vote overwhelmingly conservative. And that sounds like an oversimplification, but if you look at the sort of crosstabs and the breakdowns, it is gender polarization like in no other democracy on earth. I mean, just when you see like the ways in which younger South Korean votes, just it's just really stark. And I think this is important for just kind of setting the context for the domestic political environment that Lee Jae-myung is inheriting, right? It's a deeply polarized, divided society. And then ordinary Koreans, you know, we're talking about geopolitics on this podcast and the alliance and nuclear weapons and all of that. But ordinary Koreans, I think, you know, have much more kind of, you know, bread and butter concerns, so to speak, about inflation, cost of living, jobs, housing, all of those things that are very familiar to, I think, many voters across many advanced democracies, particularly in these last few years of greater inflation globally. So that's also just, I think, important context here.
Yeah. I think it's definitely important to keep in mind that domestic context when talking about geopolitics, because every country does have to deal with its domestic constituencies. Sort of bridging that, I wanted to ask, you know, much has really been made about the differences in approach between South Korea's liberals and conservatives when it comes to North Korea, when it comes to China. What do you expect from Lee in this area? You know, I think conservatives have been more vocal that, you know, Lee is just going to go hard to one direction. What are you expecting there?
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's this kind of oversimplification sometimes that you'll hear in Washington and in a lot of the American op-ed pages about Korean politics, which is that, you know, the Korean left are kind of pro-North Korean communists, and they're going to give away the barn to Kim Jong-un the first moment they get an opportunity. And, you know, suffice to say, that's a very simple, significant oversimplification of what Korean progressives, I think, actually believe. And it's one that I think is convenient, but it's not what we're likely to see. But, you know, with that said, I mean, Lee Jae-myung, he's quite the character, right? If you look at his his history as a domestic political figure, you know, he's got a share of scandals, kind of legal troubles, so on and so forth. He's said a variety of things over the years that people have likened to kind of, you know, Trump-like comments about the world and the Korean issues. But the thing that I would expect to see is that, you know, and you see this in Korea, you see this elsewhere, which is that you have these kind of, I guess you don't see this in the United States, where you know, you have like firebrand populist politicians who are kind of wacky when they are in parliament or in kind of a lawmaking position. But the moment they get elected to the highest office in the country, they sort of moderate, they surround themselves with expert advisors, advisors who might even have different views. And like that latter piece is what Lee Jae-myung has done, right? So if you look at the way in which he's staffing up, there's a variety of voices and perspectives with different views about, you know, the alliance with the United States, what to do about North Korea. The one that I think a lot of commentators have been pointing to is the new South Korean National Security Advisor, Lee Sung-lak, and the director of the National Intelligence Service, Lee Jong-suk. These are two men who are sort of within the progressive camp, seen as occupying different poles on the debate about strategic autonomy and the alliance with the United States. And so that's interesting because it suggests that I think, you know, advisors will ultimately help shape Lee Jae-myung's maneuvering on a lot of these issues. It's not going to be kind of this imperious one man taking all of the decisions on national security decisions, which of course sounds familiar to many of us in Washington these days. So I think that's how I would probably expect this to play out. But there is some truth to the fact that, you know, the broader disposition with which conservatives in South Korea approach alliance issues is very different from progressives. So like particularly on the extended deterrence side, some of the anxieties I think will be pretty different now. Especially if, as Lee Jae-myung has said, there is some new attempt to pursue engagement with North Korea, which, you know, we can talk about in a bit. But that's, again, I think my broader read.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk about that North Korean engagement piece, because, you know, for listeners who maybe have forgotten December, the South Korean progressives' apparent, you know, duplicity when it comes to North Korea was the genesis of Yoon's martial law declaration. And I think a lot of that is you know, vapid rumors. But I think I am curious your take on what the Yi administration's approach to North Korea will be. What have we seen so far? You mentioned some of the staffing that he's folks he's chosen for his cabinet and things, but where can we expect that relationship to go? What are the early signs?
Yeah, so, you know, in his victory speech, Lee Jae-myung spoke of seeking stable coexistence with North Korea, broadly seeking engagement, peace on the Korean Peninsula, which is a very kind of, you know, that's exactly what you would expect from a progressive leader. Of course, the context now is very different from what Moon Jae-in dealt with. For listeners who might not remember, you know, Moon Jae-in was largely one of the most important catalysts for the broader North Korea, a U.S. rapprochement that happened with the Singapore summit and the Hanoi summit in 2018 and 2019. Now, you know, the North Koreans haven't talked to the United States since October 2019. There hasn't been a serious negotiation. They've changed their policy on Korean unification. They've dismantled their internal kind of inter-Korean engagement bureaus, essentially. So they can't actually, there's no such thing as inter-Korean engagement anymore as far as the North Koreans are concerned. It is a matter to be handled by their Ministry of Foreign Affairs because South Korea is now being treated as a foreign country, which is not the case in South Korea, right? South Korea still has a Ministry of Unification that is charged with handling North Korea-related issues. So you have this asymmetry there. A lot of uncertainty. Two things I'll just say really quickly because I know we're getting a little short on time. We're heading into the end of North Korea's Eighth Party Congress period later this year, right? So Kim Jong-un's been, he's had this five-year plan of military modernization that's about to wrap up. January next year, we're expecting to see the Ninth Party Congress convened. This is the apex event in North Korea's political calendar. So it's a good opportunity for Kim Jong-un, if he has seen something different that might entice him to engage, again, the United States or South Korea, to sort of make that clear. Right now, there's no evidence that he really sees benefits to engagement, with the exception of one really interesting thing that happened recently, which was that after coming to power, Lee Jae-myung instructed South Korea to turn off the propaganda loudspeakers that have been deployed along the inter-Korean border. And in a very interesting demonstration, the North Koreans actually reciprocated that without communicating, right? So South Korea turned off its speakers, the North Koreans turned off their speakers. And that's interesting because Kim, in the Biden years, had this sort of framing that he would use to talk about the conditions under which he might engage again. And what he said was essentially goodwill for goodwill, confrontation for confrontation, right? And so the implication was that if you go first and you show me something that represents goodwill, I might do the same. And I guess we've sort of seen a little bit of evidence that maybe that's still how the North Koreans are thinking about the broader predicament today. Now, that there's some interesting implications there for the Trump administration, because we know that Donald Trump is interested in potentially re-engaging North Korea. So big question mark is, you know, will Lee Jae-myung and Trump's team, at least whatever continues to exist after the lobotomy over at the National Security Council, if they'll be able to figure out some kind of concerted effort on engaging North Korea. I'm not that optimistic, but there is a possibility there. So that's kind of the picture as Lee Jae-myung has inherited it. But I don't think anything happens this year, at least until the North Koreans wrap up their modernization program and we enter that Ninth Party Congress in 2026.
Okay. All right. Well, I've got two sort of probably not short questions left. I know there's a lot to talk about in this, so we'll try to get through them. You know, I think, how has the new South Korean administration signaled or approached that South Korea-Japan-U.S. trilateral, which we talked so much about only 2 years ago? You know, the Yoon administration tried to institutionalize that along with President Biden and then Japanese Prime Minister Kishida. And so I'm curious, you know, how we can expect the Yi administration to approach that trilateral, given that it's not so natural a fit necessarily?
Yeah, so you know, with the G7 summit just around the corner, I guess we're about to get an interesting test of this, because Lee Jae-myung has sort of indicated that he was open to holding a trilateral meeting with Ishiba. And what's interesting about Ishiba is that he's been a very strong proponent of networking with American allies and bringing together like-minded states. You know, he wrote a piece for the Hudson Institute where he talked about an Asian NATO, not an idea that he's endorsed since becoming Prime Minister of Japan, but you know, he's pretty positive as a Japanese leader is wont to be. But in Japan, I think you know, if you look at the Liberal Democratic Party, and if you go back to Prime Minister Kishida, who was sort of the Prime Minister who was in place when all of the trilateral stuff really got off the ground, the hesitation was precisely this outcome in South Korean domestic politics, that, you know, it's all fine and good to talk to Yoon Suk-yeol, who was remarkably outspoken on engagement with Japan, but that you would eventually get a, you know, return to the equilibrium in South Korean politics, and you'd have a progressive administration that would be difficult to deal with. So I think, you know, Lee Jae-myung is trying to preserve that continuity. And the reasons, I think, really just have to do with the fact that despite the many well-known grievances, you know, historical territorial disputes between Japan and South Korea, they ultimately do have quite a few shared threat perceptions, convergent national interests. So there are very good reasons for the two countries to play nice, especially at this moment when the United States is not in many ways behaving in the ways that allies would want to see around the world. So it's this really interesting, unprecedented situation, right? Because even during the first Trump administration, when we saw Japan-South Korea relationships get really bad, the threat perceptions, you know, were still pretty different, I would say, at that moment, right? This is a very different Northeast Asia, very different world geopolitically. So that might, and, you know, something will probably happen where we'll have a crisis and things will go off the rails, as happened under Moon Jae-in. But for the moment, it seems like the trilateral boat is not quite as rocky as it could be.
All right. And, you know, we've been sort of dancing around the Trump angle, but I don't think we can get out of a 2025 podcast without directly addressing, you know, how has South Korea managed the relationship with the Trump administration and with a new president in office? You know, how do we think that the administration is going to approach talks on things like tariffs, alliance burden sharing, and sort of the hot button issues? What hints have we seen so far about that relationship?
Yeah, so this is the tough one, right? Because when you have a progressive leader prioritizing kind of strategic autonomy in South Korea, you know, the kind of chauvinistic unilateralism that the United States brings to a lot of its deliberations is not going to go over well. We already went through a very acrimonious cost-sharing dispute under the first Trump administration when it came to the alliance with South Korea, when what used to be about a $1 billion U.S. dollar host nation support payment from South Korea, the Trump administration upped their ask to $5 billion just overnight, completely arbitrarily, which was, of course, not taken very well. Fortunately, you know, things got ironed out under the Biden administration, but this is going to rear its head once again. Even though they did finalize a cost-sharing agreement before the Biden administration left, with the intention of getting that done before Trump sort of came in. The big issues at the forefront are, you know, if the Pentagon under Trump is going to significantly alter the nature of U.S. forces on the Korean Peninsula. And there's a lot there. The number that's been sort of bandied about in the Wall Street Journal, and I think a few other sources, was a reduction on the order of around 4,500 troops out of 28,500 total. And, you know, there's a conversation there, like, is 28,500 sort of this sacrosanct number that is essential for deterrence, or can you deter North Korea at lower numbers of U.S. personnel? Mm-hmm. Some people say you can, some people say you can't. I mean, my opinion is that that would actually harm readiness, but it all matters about how these decisions are framed, right? If that withdrawal takes place and the answer is, you know, South Korea can handle North, you know, South Korea should build nuclear weapons maybe and handle North Korea on its own, that's very different than kind of an adjustment that it takes into account South Korean security interests and maybe brings certain capabilities to the Korean Peninsula that offset the removal of troops. There's just a lack of clarity at the moment. But the other thing is, you know, this question about how much is South Korea willing to play ball on the U.S.-China strategy? And there, I think things are tough with the progressive administration because they remember the unofficial sanctions against South Korea after South Korea accepted the U.S. THAAD missile defense system back in 2016 into 2017 when the South Korean economy lost billions. You know, major South Korean firms suffered pretty substantially as a result of those Chinese sanctions. So there won't be tremendous enthusiasm to entertain those parts of the Trump agenda, and that could lead to turbulence. But I think South Korea is going to try to handle that with as much finesse as it can diplomatically. But finesse only takes you so far with the Trump administration. And then, you know, the broader picture here, there's just one more interesting kind of issue that listeners might not know about, but it's this issue called OPCON transfer, which is the wartime control of military forces on the Korean Peninsula. So South Korean progressives have for a very long time wanted to accelerate OPCON transfer because it's sort of a national autonomy and sovereignty issue. Currently, as the alliance exists in a time of war with North Korea, alliance troops would be under the leadership of an American general. So you can see why, if you're a strategic autonomy-minded progressive in South Korea, that's not very acceptable to you. So the current approach has been conditions-based. Basically, if South Korea reaches a number of mutually agreed benchmarks on capabilities, command and control, operational readiness, OPCON transfer can happen, and then forces would be led by a South Korean general during a time of war. This is likely to potentially rear its head because the Trump administration might actually have no problem with just removing those conditions and doing this, right? Because it would potentially work for the America Firsters who want allies to do more. And it would work for a strategic autonomy-minded South Korean president who could say that, you know, I got this done after my predecessors failed for a while. Again, doing this in the wrong way could have some undesirable consequences, in my opinion. So just one more issue to flag. All of this, I think, is going to percolate over the coming months and next few years.
All right. Well, we will keep an eye on it. Thanks to our listeners for hanging in on this slightly longer than normal episode. Thank you for always listening. And please leave a review, rate our podcast wherever it is that you listen to it, recommend it to friends, and we'll be back soon with more.
Thanks, Katie.
Thank you.